Good morning, everyone. Good to see you today. Thanks for coming out today. One of the things we're going to begin by asking is, what's your favorite love song? Maybe throw some names out here, and they got to be appropriate love songs, but what are some of your favorite love songs? Michelle? Michelle, okay. What's your wife's name? Okay. It was a long time ago, right? Sorry, Ken, I had to do that one. What else? Love Story. Yeah, that's an old one. Old song. I can remember that, my mom crying to that when I was a kid. Anybody else? Unchained Melody? Okay. Well, I pulled up, and I was thinking about this, so I pulled up Billboard's top love songs, and I think this is top producing love songs, probably. I don't know if it's the most favorite love songs, but they're top producing love songs. Number five, Silly Little Love Song by The Wings. You remember that one? That's a 70s song for us that are a little bit older. Number four, How Deep Is Your Love by the Bee Gees. I should have had Noah sing that for us today, so. Need a little falsetto there. Number three, We Found Love by Rihanna. That's more of a modern song. Number two, I'll Make Love to You by Boys to Men. Shame on you, boys. 1994. And then number one, can you guess number one? Oh, sorry again. Yeah, guess it now. Endless Love. Very good, Josh. Very good. No, Endless Love by Lionel Richie and Diana Ross, one of the great love songs. Now, here's some of the worst love songs that I went and looked them up, and I kind of picked out five of them that I thought that probably aren't the best kinds of songs to you. The first one is Love Stinks by Jay Giles Band. That's probably not a very good love song. The second one is by Michael Bolton. I said I loved you, but I lied. A third one, I'll Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That by Meatloaf. Okay. Third, Muskrat Love. Now, yeah, but Muskrat Love, come on now. Can you imagine telling your wife that she looks like a muskrat? That's not going to be good, right? See, Muskrat, it is actually a good song, but when you think of it, Muskrat Love, we have one out in the pond. Now, this last one's kind of stretching it a little bit, but I thought, I'm In Love With the Stripper by T-Pain. That doesn't sound like a decent song. Those are all listed in the top songs. Well, there's some top Christian songs. I'm just going to list these very, if you go to K-Love, which is a website, there's actually a list of those songs on there that you can look at, and then you can actually see the videos of these. But you can just put them on there, Maggie, just because there's a big long list of those, right? Yep. God Gave You to Me by David Barnes. I Will Be Here. We sang that we had that at our wedding back in 1992, so that's a great old song. Broken Together is a fabulous song about struggles in marriage. When God Made You by New Song, it's a beautiful song. Love Is Not a Fight. Go ahead and list all the rest. And We Will Dance by Stephen Curtis. Work your way through that. Anyways, they're all great songs. What I really like about them, maybe some of the ones that are sung on Billboard's top, is really kind of lovey-dovey. The songs that are the Christian ones are kind of really hardcore as far as struggles and things, but you love your partner through that. So they're really kind of cool. So in your worship program, I left a little site that you can go and you can pull down those songs or at least listen to those songs. They have the videos there. They're really fabulous songs, love songs. Well, we started a series last week about a love song. It's a love song that's found in the Old Testament of the Bible. It's in a book called The Song of Songs. In fact, it begins right in the very beginning that this is the Song of Songs, or this is Solomon, his Song of Songs, his greatest song that he has ever written. It's a song, it's a very poetic book, but it's very, it's really talking about the love between two people, and it's very dramatic, and it's also very descriptive. In fact, it gets very descriptive, and it's a little hard sometimes to share that on Sunday mornings with a lot of folks because it's very descriptive of their relationship with each other. What's really neat about it is it's a love between a married couple, and it kind of goes in different scenes. It kind of starts out with their courtship, and then kind of the night before their wedding as they're really excited about being together and sharing their sharing themselves with each other. And then it talks about the wedding night. And then from after that, it talks about more scenes of their love as it expands and it grows. And so very descriptive. It uses beautiful language of that time period. The Old Testament was written in Hebrew, so some of the images and the metaphors are hard for us to understand. Like last week we talked about, as they were complimenting each other, he complimented her and said, "She is like a mare. She is like Pharaoh's mare." And I don't know if ladies like to be called horses or not, but that didn't sound very appropriate. But when you know the background of Pharaoh's mare, very expensive horses, very unique horses, beautiful horses, even divine-like. They were looked up as almost divine. So now that changes the whole metaphor when he says, "You are like Pharaoh's mare. You are like, you are divine." That's pretty beautiful. So this book is really interesting. It's the first time I've ever preached through it in 26 years because I stayed away from it. It's too mushy-gushy for me. But it's very, very important that we do because the world defines what love is for us. And as we grow up in the church, we can, and our kids grow up, as they struggle, and all of us struggle throughout life trying to figure out what relationships are about, it's very, very important that we look to what God expects of us and what God wants us for our relationships. And so we do have to talk about tough topics sometimes in our own life, some topics of sin, but we need to talk about topics of intimacy as well and sex. And so this week we're talking about their passion for each other. Next week we're actually going to be talking about God's view of sex. And so if there's some kids, I know I really encourage the teenagers to be a part of this next week because you need to hear these kinds of things. But if you have younger children that you don't want here next week, we can make sure to send them downstairs so that they, it's probably good that they go ask questions. I already had one family out here today. Their little boy was looking on their bulletin and they said, "Mom, what are those three words mean? Love, God, and sex." And so she tried to explain a little bit to a little five-year-old or four or five-year-old. But she says, "We'll talk about that later." But these are important things to talk about. And so today I want to talk about patient passion. And this is found in Songs, the second chapter, verse 7, and then it goes to chapter 3, verse 5. And in this section that we're going to be looking at today, we see two people who are very much in love, and they cannot wait to be with each other on their wedding night. There's a tension as they long to be together, yet they know that they must be patient. And because passion is so powerful, it can harm a relationship if unleashed at the wrong time, in the wrong context, and with the wrong person. It begins in Songs 2, verse 7, where it says this, "Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires." That's kind of the theme verse of this section here. And she's challenging him in this first passage that we looked at. They're very much in love, and you know that based on how they describe each other. But she's warning the young girls in her culture. They said, "Be careful about this because it can get out of control. And so I want you to hold back a little bit. There's a right time for this to happen." And so she starts out with this, and then the section will end with the very same verse. So everything in between is a description of what they're trying to tell us. Again, the daughters of Jerusalem are these very young Jewish women that they're ready to find husbands. And she's giving them advice about how powerful passion can be between two lovers. But she also warns that not to arouse that love, not to go beyond that passion until the right time in marriage. So now, first thing that we see is the female speaking. And I should qualify this too. This is a poem, and it's a conversation going back and forth. There's a female, there's a young man, some think a shepherd and a shepherdess from a poor village. And then there's some women that speak in between here as well, kind of her friends that comment. And so it's kind of sectioned off, and hopefully I can point that out to you as we look at these verses individually. So I want to look at this section, and then I want to do some application at the end of it. So first, the female is speaking, and she's talking about her lover pursuing him, or her, excuse me, verse 8 and 9. "Listen," she says, "my beloved, look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice." I think it's interesting that she doesn't describe him as a tiger or a lion, but gazelles. And gazelles were beautiful, powerful animals. And they also possessed skills of quiet and stealth, enabling them to approach someone without detecting and to stare at them. Maybe you've ever seen that out. I have a number of images on the farm where we've seen deer, and when they see you, they stop and they stare at you and they look, and then they kind of slowly make their way. And this is the image that she has as a gazelle that's powerful. And it's not only just standing there, but it's leaping, it's gaping, it's really excited to go to where her mate or his mate might be. And the image is that she sees her loved one walking towards her place, and he's excited to get there. There's an energy that he's approaching with. And in her mind, she pictures this beautiful gazelle. She sees him, and he comes to the wall, and he's trying to catch a glimpse of her. He is looking through the windows and the lattices, just kind of peering through, just like a deer would look through, trying to find out where danger is, looking through the trees. He's looking through to try to get a glimpse of her because he's excited to see her. He's not a peeping Tom. That's not the point of it. He's just really glad to be able to catch a glimpse of her. I don't know if you remember, but do you remember how exciting it was for your mate, if you're married, how exciting it was to be able to see her or to see him? And this, that tension and that excitement. I remember when Carrie's my wife, and we first met. We went to college out here, but I first met her when she was a sophomore in high school. Her sister was attending out here, and she came to visit. And the smart aleck girl was standing on number 7 unit over there, and I threw a snowball at her because she smarted off at me. So she was just this young sophomore. But then I met her again 2 years later at a Bible camp where I was a counselor, and she was a senior, and she was going to be attending our college here in the fall. That was the fall of 1988. And so we hit it off really well at the camp, and you could tell just by the drool on her face that she had something very... You could tell that we were clicking very well. At the end of that summer, the Bible college used to gather all the camp kids at Valley Fair. And I heard that she was going to be there, so I wanted to go. Now, that was before cell phones. There was a time period when we didn't have cell phones. And so she came with her group from Staples, and I came from the Bible college here since I was a student. And all day long, we spent walking around trying to find each other. And we would, and then literally all day long. And so we would stop when we'd see someone that we knew from camp. Hey, did you see Carrie Stohansky? Yeah, she just was walking that way. She says that she's looking for you. And I go, really? She said, yep, she's looking. Okay, so you're off running. And so you're walking around all day long. We looked for each other, couldn't find each other until the park was closing. And there she was at the front of the door. And we went and talked for a brief moment. And that was it. Until she came to school. Talk about tension. But that image that I have here of this woman in her house, and they're looking for each other. They really long to see each other, and how excited they were to do so. Now it's the man's turn, and the man responds this way. Verse 10 through 13. My beloved spoke and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me. See, the winter is past. The rains are over and gone. Flowers appear on the earth. The season of singing has come. The cooing of doves is heard in our land. The fig tree forms its early fruit, and the blossoming vines spread their fragrance. Arise, come, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me. Again, the image here is one of winter, that it's ending. It's the rainy season there. It's not necessarily a snowy season for them in that area, but it's a rainy season, and it's still limited what you could do. And that season is ending, and now things are coming to life, and they're growing. You can see blossoms, and you're listening to doves. The doves would come back from their migration at this time period, and so there's a lot of noise. It's like out here, there's a lot of noise in the springtime with the frogs croaking and the birds coming back. Life is starting to take shape, and that's the image, that it's springtime, and it's fresh, and the animals start to kind of hook up with each other, and our geese are having their little ones out here. You saw Jake the turkey. He's all excited. He made the news this week, I saw on TV, as he held up traffic down here, but we got a turkey couple out here. I wanted to call him Stovetop, but somebody called him Jake. Stovetop stuffing, by the way. That's what they... And so that's the image of life coming together, and he comes to his house, or comes to her house, and he wants her to come out and go for a walk. And you can just see the guy, come on, trying to convince her to come out. She's a little hesitant to come out. Come on, it's beautiful out there, the weather's nice, and those sneaky guys trying to lure these young girls out into the open. But it was very harmless. It was meant, they just simply wanted to be together, and he wanted to be with her. And so he's anxious to see her, so he's begging her to come out of her house so that they can go for a walk. He's trying to convince her to come, but she's hesitant. And then it's really interesting that they both sing this in verse 15. They say, "Catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, our vineyards that are in bloom." So that's a very loaded statement there. Foxes were terms used at that time period for frisky boys. How about that? That's probably the best way to say that. Frisky boys. And she was saying, wait, whoa. Before we do this, let's pray. Let's make sure that nothing gets in the way of our love for each other. Vineyards is a term used for their body. And they both sing that, yes, we're very passionate, but we don't want anything to ruin this moment. We won't want to jump the gun here. We want to be passionate for each other, but we want to wait for our wedding night before we jump into things and really consummate that marriage. So catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards. Our vineyards that are in bloom. So they're ready for that. They're excited about that, but they're concerned, and they want to hold back a little bit and cool off a little bit. She responds this way in verse 16. "My beloved is mine, and I am his. He browses among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the rugged hills." She too senses that this might be going a little bit too far, but she wants to restate her position. My beloved is mine and I am his. They possess each other. They are committed to each other. When we get married, one of the things that we say is, "I take you to be my wife," and you say, "I take you to be my husband." There's a possession there. That's commitment. That you commit to each other, but you also commit your bodies and your life to each other so that you are one in everything. And so she's reestablishing that my beloved is mine and I am his, and he browses the lilies. I am his. He can dwell within me or upon me. It's like, I know it's a crazy image, but grazing. But the whole point is, I am his. But until the day breaks and the shadow flees, turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or like a stag. It's kind of like a stag comes out or a gazelle comes out in the morning, and then when the day breaks, they go back off into their hiding. She's telling them to wait, that we need to hold on. But then something happens that night. She goes to her sleep, and in chapter 3, verse 1 through 3, it says, "All night long in my bed," this is her talking, "I looked for the one my heart loves, and I looked for him but did not find him. I will get up now and go about the city, through its streets and squares. I will search for the one my heart loves. So I looked for him, but did not find him. The watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city." Have you seen the one my heart loves? You know, she can't stop thinking about him. She lays down at night, and I think the interpreters or the commentators say that it's possible that she's dreaming, but she knew that she had a chance to be with him, but they decided not to, so she goes to bed at night. She's thinking about it, and she probably nods off, and she wakes up hoping that he might be there, but he's not. And then she has this dream that she goes out, looks for him, and of course, in a dream, you can't find him, so there's that tension. And so then she talks with the guards. The guards knew everybody that came into the city, and they didn't even know where he was. So it's this idea that she's just thinking about him all night long, and she can hardly wait to be with him. And then it says in verse 4, "Scarcely had I passed when then I found the one my heart loves, and I held him and would not let him go until I brought him to my mother's house, to the room of the one who conceived me." She finds him in her dream, and she wants to bring them home, and she can't wait for the night that they're going to consummate their marriage. That passion is very real, and those feelings are very real. But again, then she ends this section, her dream, by restating what we began with in verse 5. It says, "Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken until it so desires." And so that's all section off there. So it's a beautiful expression of two people longing to be together. And note that there's nothing wrong with wanting to be together, even wanting to be together sexually. There are all natural things that God has created in us that draws us together. Couples today, when they develop their relationship together, they can get caught up into the moment. Feelings are hard to throw off to the side and ignore, but it has to be right, and you have to love the right person as well. But then you add in all the other chemicals that are taking place with inside of us. And so it's very hard to hold back when we get into those moments. That's the beauty of this poem, is that they have all those feelings, they have all those chemical reactions, all those things that make us feel good inside, but they say no. And so that tells me that yes, we can say no as well. That the whole idea of constraint and restraining yourself, even though these emotions are very real for each other. So I like the honesty of this passage, and I also like the guidelines of this passage as well. And it's very important for us to follow those. And I think the point of this passage is this, that we need to trust God's timing for intimacy within marriage. I think that's the whole point of it, that we have to trust His timing and not our own. Most people, if you look at the statistics, within very few dates are being together and sharing each other sexually. And that's way too early in order to discover what a person is like. As we will learn next week, sex is very powerful. There's something, I think, spiritual that happens between two people that share their lives with each other in that manner. It is the most intimate way to express yourself. And if you do that with so many people, a little bit of you is taken away, I think, from you. That's why God wants us to keep that within the context of marriage. And when you read about it, and when they do surveys, the happiest people that are enjoying their relationships are those that have been in married relationships. Again, we'll talk more about the intimacy issues later. I just wanted to highlight this point about waiting. Patient passion. It's okay to fall in love. It's okay to have all those kinds of feelings, but we have to hold it back until the moment is right. So why do we need to wait? You know, delayed gratification is probably a word not found in our American culture. Delayed gratification. When we can get loans to get whatever we want immediately, when we can get our food immediately, I get frustrated at McDonald's if I don't get it within a couple minutes. And you used to wait for 20 minutes to get food at restaurants long ago when I grew up. So delayed gratification, we want it now, is not necessarily something that we believe in today, but that's really what we're talking about. So why do we wait? Especially, why do we wait to share intimately with another person in the context of marriage? Well, one is because of the social consequences. Social consequences. When we are together before we are in a committed relationship, a lot of things can happen. We can get young women can become pregnant, and that changes their life. My wife does daycare, and for many years, and we've worked with a number of single parents, and I'm so proud of how hard they work. It is a struggle for them to work hard, and they love their little boys or little girls, and it has nothing to do with what they've done in the long run. It's just how difficult it is to parent a child when you're the only one. That's a consequence of consummating something before you have a committed relationship. Again, research shows over and over again how important it is to have two in your family to take care, to provide income, to watch kids if you need to go to the doctor. It compounds itself when you're the only one doing so. You get sexual addictions with people that, you know, go out looking for their next thrill, a next conquered victim, whoever they might be. Sexually transmitted diseases. I just read in the Tribune how that's just rising again. After all the teaching, after all the lessons in college, after all the education, after all the scares, yet that is still rising within our young people, which is really surprising to us. And then this idea of living together, and a lot of people like to live together because they think it makes sense. Maybe their families were divorced, and so they don't want to go through that, so they want to make sure that they're finding the right person. But in actuality, living together increases your divorce rate by about 30%. They say recent studies have shown that if you're married and you didn't live together beforehand, you have about a 20% chance that your marriage, or excuse me, 20% of those marriages will end in a divorce. If you lived together before you were married, that goes up to 50%. So 50% will end in divorce if you start living together beforehand. And so logically, it makes sense. You save money if you live together. You can share a house if you live together. There's a lot of things, but really in the long run, it doesn't help you. It actually causes more stress, and it actually, it doesn't work that way. Now, some do, and you might know some people that have, but the numbers even go up further if a person is just committed to living together and they're never married. In 10 years, 70% of them will be divorced. That's if they don't commit in marriage at all. And so those are social consequences when it comes to kind of jumping into our passions and not waiting for the right moment. And then studies have shown having sex with more than one partner affects the divorce rate and our happiness in our marriage relationships as well. We use it kind of as an entertainment tool, and sex is fun. But it has to be, again, in the right context. Otherwise, there's something that happens that when we use it, when we do it over and over and again with multiple partners, that it affects us on the inside. We don't think about it, but it really does. All right. That's the social consequences. There's spiritual consequences as well that we need to weigh. First, God created sex to be shared between the married people, a man and a woman. And I think God, if he's a pretty smart God, I think. When you look at our bodies, just ask a doctor how complex they are and how wonderfully organized they are. And if God gives us some instruction, he's not a prude. He's not trying to prevent us from having fun. He wants us to enjoy life and life to its fullest. Jesus says that in John 10:10. I want to give you life and life to your fullest. But you got to follow my guidelines for that. If you follow my guidelines for life, that's when you can have life to its fullest. God wants it. He loves us. He created us. He knows exactly how we work. He knows exactly how our minds work. He knows exactly how our bodies work. And so when he says, don't do this, please don't do this, and wait, he knows what he's talking about. But again, we think that we're pretty smart, and we say, whatever, Lord, we really love this person. We know this is the right one. And then we jump into that later to break up later on in life, and then you have all these scars in your life because of all these bad relationships. If we just listen to what God asks us to do. So the spiritual consequence is that God created sex to be shared between married people. And to have sex outside of marriage is always condemned as a sin in the Bible. There's never an opportunity for that to be something that's a positive. It's always a sin. And again, God's trying to protect us. He's not trying to be a mean old, some people, a mean old grandpa that won't let us do anything. That's not the point of it. He's trying to protect our souls. He's trying to protect the family. He's trying to protect marriage. And if we just did it his way, it goes a lot better. Now, it doesn't guarantee that it will go perfect. No, I know Christian couples that did it right, and they struggle because we live in a fallen world. But it's an ideal that we can at least shoot for, that we can't just top off to the side because everybody else is doing it this way. And lightning hasn't struck them yet, so it looks like they're doing just fine, right? But in the end, we'll be held accountable to God. This is why in the New Testament of the Bible, sexual relations are talked about a lot. And the Apostle Paul was a person that did a lot of teaching in the church and started many churches. And he sent this letter to a church in Colossae, and it says in Colossians 3, verse 2 through 7, he says, now that you know Jesus, set your mind on things above, not on the earthly things, for you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ. You put away that old life that you used to be a part of. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Now Jesus is our life now. We want to live the way that he wants us to live. So what do? Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality and impurity and lust and evil desires and greed, which is adultery. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. So that's very strong language about what we need to stay away from, because that's the spiritual consequence. And it doesn't matter in the long run. You go a long ways to make sure that your mate is happy. What's most important is that God's happy with your life. And sometimes you're going to have to say no. And when you get into pressure situations, I've had to turn a couple of different breakups. I've had breakups. Somebody's broken up with me. I don't know why. Haven't got over that yet. But a couple of times I had to break it off. And it was all because that it was going to a place that I couldn't go. And that's hard to do when you really like each other and when you have some compatibility. But what we will be measured is not if we please our spouse or please our significant other, it's if we please God. And that's the spiritual consequences of jumping in and not being patient with our passion. Okay, that's the tough stuff. Let's go some positive things. I always like to help people figure out what they can do to protect themselves and to some practical things that you can do. So how do you protect your passion? This is geared to non-married folks, okay? It's not just that your love for each other. There are chemical reactions going on inside of you that are raring to get out when you're close to each other. So you got to be careful. So here's just some real practical advice. Number one, set boundaries right up front with the person that you're dating. Set boundaries with them and say, this is where we're not going to go, so get it out of your head. And that's a really good thing to start out from the very beginning, because it will weed out those people that are looking for something else. I always tell young people, and you know, don't even kiss a person for 6 months. They're going like, what? Are you kidding me? I said, because the only reason I say that is it will weed out people that are looking for something else. Build your relationship on a relationship. And all those other things, those passionate things, kind of skew that a little bit. They're meant to be added after you have a relationship and you're married, not before, because that messes it all up a little bit. I'm not saying that you can't smooch a little bit or switch spit or whatever you want to call it. That makes it gross now. See, I'm trying to make it gross. You know how many germs are in your mouth? No, I'm just... Set boundaries up front. And I really... Guys, I think it would be awesome if you did this. The gals would appreciate you very much. And really encourage gals or women to do this as well, up front. Most guys can be predators. And they're hunting. They're hunters. They have that warrior mentality. And... I know because I'm a guy. And so I think you set that up front. That helps you kind of defend yourself from that. But guys, especially young teenage guys that haven't started dating yet, you be a hero to your girlfriend. You stand up and protect them. And that goes a long ways to building a great relationship. Number two, stay away from tempting situations. Stay away from tempting situations. It might not be good to go for the weekend somewhere by yourself or go into a tent by yourself, because that's a tempting situation. No one else is around, no one else is seeing you. And so when we were growing up, we were always supposed to envision that your mom was sitting in the back seat of your car. And so that would guide it didn't work some of the times, but that was the image that we had. Tempting situations. It could be looking at the wrong kinds of movies that are stimulating. It could be locations. A lot of times it's just going off by yourself somewhere that really can kind of lure you in and at the right moment. It could be that you're in a intimate moment in the sense of that you're holding hands and you start kissing a little bit, but then those chemicals start going and you just want to get a little... Maybe you need to stay away from those kinds of things so that you're going into a tempting situation. Another one I thought, number three, I thought, I like this one. I got this from another author, All Four on the Floor. Maggie asked me, he goes, what do you mean by that? That means none on the bed, all on the floor. If you're sitting on a couch, don't wrap each other around like this. That's probably not a good thing to kind of grab, you know, like that. Keep your feet on the floor. Then you're not touching each other. You're not rubbing up against each other. And it's just careful. Those things stimulate you. I just remember... Carrie and I, so we this is where we courted right out here. I can tell you that. I'm not going to tell you all the things here. But I remember the first time I held her hand and how awesome that was. The warts didn't bother me at all. It was just that I'm just teasing. She's not here to enjoy that. Shoot. She will find out. No, she doesn't have any warts. But I can just remember just that, how exciting that was just to hold her hand. And so I know, we've been through that. We know what the chemical reactions are and how careful that you need to be. So all four on the floor. So be careful about making sure. I think that was really good advice. You can do with it with whatever you want to, but I liked it. Number four, bring others with you. If you're worried about being by yourself, go on double dates, or if you go on a trip, there's nothing wrong with going on a trip somewhere, but bring somebody else with you so that there's accountability. And then the last thing is look nice but modest. Look nice but modest. You know, maybe it's somebody that would rather wear a t-shirt and jeans every day of his life. I'm not a big dresser, or shorts and jeans, or shorts and... But my goodness, sometimes if I go to do some weddings for people and I look out at the crowd, I'm going like, holy smoke, some of these people dress up to the... I don't know what they're dressing for, but wow! Wow, wow, wow. It's almost like they're trying to impress everybody there. There's nothing wrong with dressing up. Don't get me that. But maybe to be more modest about it so it's not so... It gets kind of crazy sometimes with that. And I'm not a prude either, so don't call me a prude. But I just think... I do have a daughter, and I did pick out her... I was in Savers one day, and I picked out her prom dress for her. It was long-sleeved. And it went all the way down to her legs. And I can't remember what color it was. And I think it came all the way up to her neck. I said, that's beautiful. That's an awesome dress. She goes, no, not going to happen. But modesty, I think is very, very important, that we don't give people the wrong impressions. You can look nice. There's nothing wrong about dressing up nice. Simple advice. I know some of it's kind of silly, but I think that helps protect your passion. Ephesians 5 verse 3 says, but among you there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality or any kind of impurity or of greed. Why? Because these are improper for God's holy people. Holy means unique, separated. It means different. It's improper for God's people to do so. Not even a hint of it. So I just wanted to emphasize how important it is that we remember that. All right, so that's for single people, non-married people. I want to talk about some married people as well, because they've lost their passion. They've lost that loving feeling. Oh, that loving feeling. And so I want to talk a little bit, as we end our time together here, about how to pump up your passion with each other, because that's a beautiful thing in a relationship. This is not a bad thing that we're reading in Song of Psalms. It's just the proper context, right? But you can lose that in a marriage very quickly. In fact, it's building up all that emotion and energy. It comes up to your wedding, and then you're married, and you start living life, and then you have to go to work, and then you have to take care of kids, and you're exhausted, and one of the things that you lose is passion. And so how do you maintain that and enjoy what God wants us to enjoy? First thing is this. Take time to talk to each other. You're going like, how does that increase your passion? Well, you talk to each other. A lot of times we don't talk to each other. We don't talk about deeper things, or we don't talk about important things, or maybe private things. I know in our conversation, if we're busy day, I'm not a great big talker. I like to talk in front of people. I don't like to talk individually to people. I do. I shouldn't say that. I'm not a touchy-feely, express myself relationally kind of person. That's what I meant. I like talking to you guys, okay? But take time to talk to each other. And when we sit down and actually talk, you come away feeling like you're closer, because you actually communicated to each other. You had a conversation. Now, I'm not talking about yelling at each other and nagging about it to each other. Not that. You got to throw that off. I mean actually talking nice to each other. And looking into each other's eyes. Not googly-goggly, but just paying attention to each other. Don't bring this out. Don't talk that way with your texting. Talk to each other. Verbalize it. Verbalize it. Second thing, go on dates. This is very important for you guys with younger kids as well, because I know how exhausting it is. And I know for my wife still does daycare with 8 kids every day at home for 7.5 hours. Her daycare, I figured out, 67.5 hours that she watches kids. So that's exhausting. And the only way that we've helped with that, the most we know that we're in trouble sometimes, and that's when Carrie says, we need to go out on a date. And so that we take time to do that. On a Friday, we get babysitters. And trust me, guys and gals, husbands and wives, it's worth the money. Don't put it into your budget for somebody to watch your kids and to pay for a hotel room or whatever you need to do, okay? Because that is so important for your relationship to do that. And it's amazing what a weekend will do. A weekend will give you another 3 months to be alive and to keep your head above water. But go on dates. It's worth it. And then when you do, go fun places. Ours is very simple. It's usually to go out to eat and then to go to a movie, and that's it. But that goes a long ways to help in your relationship. Number 3, discover each other's love language. That came out with a book a few years ago, 5 Languages of Love, and it's a very good book. A lot of counselors use that, because if you figure this out, guarantee if you figure this out, you'll get it, and things will be a lot better at home. And the 5 things that the author talks about are what he says. There's 5 ways that we like to express or receive love to each other. One is words of affirmation. There's some of you that just need a lot of encouragement, a lot of buildup, and you love to hear, I love you, you're the best, those kinds of words. That's what makes you feel loved. A second one some people feel is quality time, that we just need to spend time with each other. That's what really makes me feel loved. And so when we're busy, 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 we might feel distance there, but when we spend time with each other and do things together, that really helps us go a long way. C is receiving gifts. Some of you absolutely have to have a Valentine's gift to feel love, or a Valentine's card to feel love, or a Christmas gift to feel love, and all those kinds of things. That's one thing that Carrie and I are not gift givers. So when I'd go buy a card, it's like $5. $5 for a card to say I love you. So what I do now is as I give her $5 and say I love you. See, it goes a long ways that way. Then I ask her for the $5 back so I can put it back into my allowance money that she gave me to use during the week. But some people like that. I'm not, and sometimes cards are wonderful for people. But receiving and giving of gifts, and that's the other thing, we don't do a lot of gift giving anymore because it came out of the same account. So we would just, what we do is we love to give gifts to our kids, and so we emphasize that. Once in a while, we'll give special gifts to each other, but that wasn't our love language. See? Acts of service, that's when someone does little things to make you feel loved. And I know this is my wife's love language. She loves it when I clean up and help her clean up and do yard work and those kinds of things. That's what really makes her feel loved. And so every day, once I found that out, at the end of the day, and I do this, I'm not kidding about this, that she goes to bed, I clean all the dishes and I make sure that her kitchen is spotless and all the dishes are put away and wiped so that when she wakes up in the morning, the kitchen is perfectly clean. And that helps her start her day without this big pile of mess in there. So that's kind of, and then I'll fold clothes if I need to do that, if that's part of my instructions. I usually pick up all the toys and I'll fold all the blankets in the living room. So again, everything is spotless when she comes in. I can't guarantee that it was because I have kids that bring dishes in the middle of the night and they're sitting there in the morning, but most of the time we get that done. And she loves that, and she's told me that. That's what makes her feel loved. And the last thing is physical touch. Some people like to hold hands and hug and smooch or whatever it is that they like, but they feel loved when there's that kind of action taking place there. All right, so think about those things and talk about those with your spouse and find out what it is that they really feel loved by, and then do them. And you'll be amazed at how better they feel and how closer they feel to you because you're paying attention to those kinds of things. Number four, do something your mate likes to do, even if it's not your favorite thing to do. I'll give you an example of that. Carrie and I went out, we like to go up to the cities for a weekend, just our date weekend. And so we just go out to eat, we go to used bookstores, I hunt for books, she hunts for toys for daycare, and we have a blast doing that. That's just what we do. I mean, we also will hit some of the sites, some of the waterfalls up in the city, so on and so forth. So we were sitting there thinking about what we should do. This is last summer, and she goes, I think we should go to a baseball game. I went, what? I said, I love sports. And Carrie doesn't care about sports. I go, what did you say? And I said, she goes, I think we should go to a baseball game. And I started crying and sobbing. I gave her a hug. You are the most wonderful wife in the whole world. No, there was, I got tingles is what I got. No. I go, you really want to go to a game with me? She goes, yeah, I think it would be, I actually kind of like baseball. I go, you do? Yeah. I said, well, that would be awesome. So as we skipped to the park, you know, skipping down, you know, it was fantastic. She did something that I love to do, but she wanted to do it because I love to do it. See, does that make sense? So find something like that your spouse loves to do, maybe you don't care about, but then do that with them. And that goes a long ways to build your passion. That just makes you feel good. And the last thing, this is harder. This is for us that are older. That helps with your passion for each other is to get in shape, is to take care of your bodies. And I don't say that to make everybody feel guilty. I say that is because we don't feel good, see? And if you don't feel good, or if you don't feel good about yourself, how do you feel good in your relationship as well? Maybe you kind of are self-conscious. So really make an effort to do what you can to kind of, and I'm not talking about bodybuilding and that kind of stuff, but work at eating better and working out a little bit and just doing what you can. And especially when you get older, it's really important because as you get older, you get more tired too. But that goes a long ways because then you start feeling better about yourself and then you feel more of, you know, just that I think that's the key. Just feel better about yourself, and so you're more apt to build your relationship in a better way. Okay, quick advice for that. Proverbs 5, verse 18 and 19 says this, may you rejoice, sorry the language here, but it's just descriptive. I tried to find it in another way of saying it, but it's just going to be straightforward. May you rejoice in the wife of your youth, a loving doe, a graceful deer. May your breast satisfy you always. May you ever be intoxicated with her love. It just says, keep your passion alive. That's my translation for it. Keep your passion alive. You are meant to enjoy your spouse, so keep your passion alive. All right, bottom line is this, folks. Passion in our marriage doesn't necessarily start with a wild sex life. Passion starts with a healthy relationship. So work on building healthy relationships with each other first, before you are married, so that you, when you get together and you're married, can enjoy it even more. Again, the same is true with those who are not married. If you start seeing someone, work on building a healthy relationship, a holy relationship first. In Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 through 5, the author of Songs also says this. As he's reflecting about all of life and all the things that have happened to him, he writes this beautiful poem. He says, there's a time for everything, a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. By the way, this is the passage that Wren used to bring dancing in Footloose, by the way. So he quoted the Bible. It's got to be true. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. There's a time for everything. And God says, wait, be patient with your passion. And within the context of a right relationship, which is in marriage, then unleash that and enjoy it. And it's worth the wait. Okay? All right.